guardedness on his face, something close to sadness. "What's wrong?" she asked, her arm around his shoulder. "Nothing," he said. "Can we play soccer now?"
"After you tell me what happened."
"Nothing happened."
"I think you need some sugar. You'll probably have too much tomorrow, with your birthday cake. Well, let's get a cookie."
"Do you bribe the kids you babysit with sugar? Man, they're lucky." She laughed. She brought out the packet of Oreos from the fridge.
"Do you play soccer with the kids you babysit?" he asked.
"No," she said, even though she played once in a while with Taylor, kicking the ball back and forth in their oversized wooded backyard. Sometimes when DK asked her about the children she cared for, she indulged his childish interest, telling him about their toys and their lives, but she was careful not to make them seem important to her.
"So, how was camp?"
"Good." A pause. "My group leader, Haley? She gave sunscreen to everyone, but she wouldn't give me any. She said I didn't need it." She looked at his face, which was almost expressionless, eerily so. She did not know what to say.
"She thought that because you're dark you don't need sunscreen. But you do. Many people don't know that dark people also need sunscreen.
I'll get you some. Don't worry." She was speaking too fast, not sure that she was saying the right thing or what the right thing to say was, and worried because this had upset him enough that she had seen it on his face.
"It's okay," he said. "It was kind of funny. My friend Danny was laughing about it."
"Why did your friend think it was funny?"
"Because it was."
"You wanted her to give you the sunscreen too, right?"
"I guess so," he said with a shrug.
"I just want to be regular." She hugged him. Later she went to the store and bought him a big bottle of sunscreen, and the next time she visited, she saw it lying on his dresser, forgotten and unused.
Understanding America for the Non-American Black. American Tribalism. In America, tribalism is alive and well. There are four kinds: class, ideology, region, and race. First, class. Pretty easy. Rich folk and poor folk. Second, ideology. Liberals and conservatives. They don't merely disagree on political issues. Each side believes the other is evil. Intermarriage is discouraged, and on the rare occasion that it happens, is considered remarkable. Third, region. The North and the South. The two sides fought a civil war, and tough stains from that war remain. The North looks down on the South, while the South resents the North. Finally, race. There's a ladder of racial hierarchy in America. White is always on top, specifically white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, otherwise known as WASP, and American Black is always on the bottom, and what's in the middle depends on time and place. Or, as that marvellous rhyme goes, if you're white, you're all right. If you're brown, stick around. If you're black, get back. Americans assume that everyone will get their tribalism, but it takes a while to figure it all out. So, in undergrad, we had a visiting speaker, and a classmate whispers to another, "Oh my God, he looks so Jewish," with a shudder, an actual shudder, like Jewish was a bad thing. I didn't get it. As far as I could see, the man was white, not much different from the classmate herself. Jewish to me was something vague, something biblical. But I learned quickly. You see, in America's ladder of races, Jewish is white, but also some rungs below white. A bit confusing. Because I knew this straw-haired, freckled girl who said she was Jewish. How can Americans tell who is Jewish? How did the classmate know the guy was Jewish? I read somewhere how American colleges used to ask applicants for their mother's surnames to make sure they weren't Jewish, because they wouldn't admit Jewish people. So maybe that's how to tell. From people's names? The longer you are here, the more you start to get it. Chapter 18. Mariama's new customer was wearing jean shorts, the denim glued to her backside, and sneakers the same bright pink shade as her top. Large hoop earrings grazed her face. She stood in front of the mirror, describing the kind of cornrows she wanted.
"Like a zigzag, with a parting at the side, right here,
but you don't add the hair at the beginning. You add it when you get to the ponytail, she said, speaking slowly, over-enunciating. You understand me? She added, already convinced, it seemed, that Mariama did not.
I understand, Mariama said quietly. You want to see a photo? I have that style in my album.
The album was flipped through, and finally the customer was satisfied and seated, frayed plastic hoisted around her neck, her chair height adjusted, and Mariama all the time smiling a smile full of things restrained.
This other braider I went to the last time, the customer said, she was African too, and she wanted to burn my damned hair. She brought out this lighter, and I'm going, Shantae White, don't let that woman bring that thing close to your hair. So I ask her, what's that for? She says, I want to clean your braids, and I go, what? Then she tries to show me. She tries to run the lighter over one braid, and I went all crazy on her.
Mariama shook her head. Oh, that's bad. Burning is not good. We don't do that.
A customer came in, her hair covered in a bright yellow head wrap.
Hi, she said. I'd like to get braids.
What kind of braids you want?
Mariama asked. Just regular box braids, medium size.
You want it long?
Mariama asked. Not too long, maybe shoulder length?
Okay. Please, sit down. She will do it for you,
Mariama said, gesturing to Halima, who was sitting at the back, her eyes on the television. Halima stood up and stretched for a little too long, as though to register her reluctance. The woman sat down and gestured to the pile of DVDs.
You sell Nigerian films?
She asked Mariama.
I used to, but my supplier went out of business. You want to buy?
No, you just seem to have a lot of them.
Some of them are real nice,
Mariama said.
I can't watch that stuff. I guess I'm biased. In my country, South Africa, Nigerians are known for stealing credit cards and doing drugs and all kinds of crazy stuff. I guess the films are kind of like that, too.
You're from South Africa? You don't have accent,
Mariama exclaimed. The woman shrugged.
I've been here a long time. It doesn't make much of a difference.
No,
Halima said, suddenly animated, standing behind the woman.
When I come here
with my son, they beat him in school because of African accent. In Newark, if you see my son's face, purple like onion, they beat him. Black boys beat him like this. Now accent go and no problems.
I'm sorry to hear that,
the woman said.
Thank you.
Halima smiled, enamored of the woman because of this extraordinary feat, an American accent.
Yes, Nigeria very corrupt. Worst corrupt country in Africa. Me, I watch the film, but no, I don't go to Nigeria.
She half waved her palm in the air.
I cannot marry a Nigerian, and I won't let anybody in my family marry a Nigerian,
Mariama said, and darted Ifemelu an apologetic glance.
Not all, but many of them do bad things, even killing for money.
Well, I don't know about that, the customer said, in a half-heartedly moderate tone. Aisha looked on, sly and quiet. Later she whispered to Ifemelu, her expression suspicious.
You here 15 years, but you don't have American accent. Why?
Ifemelu ignored her, and once again opened Jean Toomer's cane. She stared at the words, and wished suddenly that she could turn back time and postpone this move back home. Perhaps she had been hasty. She should not have sold her condo. She should have accepted Letterly magazine's offer to buy her blog and keep her on as a paid blogger. What if she got back to Lagos and realized what a mistake it was to move back? Even the thought that she could always return to America did not comfort her as much as she wished it to. The film had ended, and in the new noiselessness of the room, Mariama's customer said,
"This one's rough,"
touching one of the thin cornrows that zigzagged over her scalp, her voice louder than it needed to be.
"No problem. I will do it again," Mariama said.
She was agreeable and smooth-tongued, but Ifemelu could tell that she thought her customer was a troublemaker, and there was nothing wrong with the cornrow. But this was a part of her new American self, this fervour of customer service, this shiny falseness of surfaces, and she had accepted it, embraced it. When the customer left, she might shrug out of that self and say something to Halima and to Aisha about Americans, how spoilt and childish and entitled they were. But when the next customer came, she would become again a faultless version of her American self. Her customer said, "It's cute," as she paid Mariama, and shortly after she left, a young white woman came in, soft-bodied and tanned, her hair held back in a loose ponytail. "Hi," she said. Mariama said, "Hi," and then waited, wiping her hands over and over the front of her shorts. "I wanted to get my hair braided. You can braid my hair, right?" Mariama smiled an overly eager smile.
"Yes, we do every kind of hair. Do you want braids or cornrows?"
She was furiously cleaning the chair now.
"Please, sit."
The woman sat down and said she wanted cornrows.
"Kind of like Bo Derek in the movie. You know that movie, Tam?"
"Yes, I know,"
Mariama said. Ifemelu doubted that she did.
"I'm Kelsey,"
the woman announced as though to the whole room. She was aggressively friendly. She asked where Mariama was from, how long she'd been in America, if she had children, how her business was doing.
"Business is up and down, but we try," Mariama said.
"But you couldn't even have this business back in your country, right? Isn't it wonderful that you get to come to the U.S. and now your kids can have a better life?"
Mariama looked surprised.
"Yes."
"Are women allowed to vote in your country?"
Kelsey asked.
A longer pause for Mariama. "Yes."
"What are you reading?"
Kelsey turned to Ifemelu. Ifemelu showed her the cover of the novel. She did not want to start a conversation, especially not with Kelsey. She recognized in Kelsey the nationalism of liberal Americans who copiously criticized America, but did not like you to do so. They expected you to be silent and grateful, and always reminded you of how much better than wherever you had come from America was.
"Is it good?"
"Yes."
"It's a novel, right? What's it about?"
Why did people ask what's it about, as if a novel had to be about only one thing? Ifemelu disliked the question. She would have disliked it, even if she did not feel, in addition to her depressed uncertainty, the beginning of a headache.
"It may not be the kind of book you would like if you have particular tastes. He mixes prose and verse."
"You have a great accent. Where are you from?"
"Nigeria."
"Oh, cool."
Kelsey had slender fingers. They would be perfect for advertising rings.
"I'm going to Africa in the fall. Congo and Kenya. And I'm going to try and see Tanzania, too."
"That's nice."
"I've been reading books to get ready. Everybody recommended Things Fall Apart, which I read in high school. It's very good, but sort of quaint, right? I mean, like it didn't help me understand modern Africa. I've just read this great book, Abandon the River. It made me truly understand how modern Africa works."
Ifemelu made a sound halfway between a snort and a hum, but said nothing.
"It's just so honest, the most honest book I've read about Africa,"
Kelsey said. Ifemelu shifted. Kelsey's knowing tone grated. Her headache was getting worse. She did not think the novel was about Africa at all. It was about Europe, or the longing for Europe, about the battered self-image of an Indian man born in Africa who felt so wounded, so diminished by not having been born European, a member of a race which he had elevated for their ability to create, that he turned his imagined personal insufficiencies into an impatient contempt for Africa. In his knowing, haughty attitude to the African, he could become, even if only fleetingly, a European. She leaned back on her seat and said this in measured tones. Kelsey looked startled. She had not expected a mini lecture. Then she said kindly,
"Oh, well, I see why you would read the novel like that."
"And I see why you would read it like you did," Ifemelu said. Kelsey raised her eyebrows, as though Ifemelu was one of those slightly unbalanced people who are best avoided. Ifemelu closed her eyes. She had the sensation of clouds gathering over her head. She felt faint. Perhaps it was the heat. She had ended a relationship in which she was not unhappy, closed a blog she enjoyed, and now she was chasing something she could not articulate clearly, even to herself. She could have blogged about Kelsey, too, this girl who somehow believed that she was miraculously neutral in how she read books, while other people read emotionally.
"You want to use hair?"
Mariama asked Kelsey.
"Hair?"
Mariama held up a pack of the attachments in a see-through plastic wrapping. Kelsey's eyes widened, and she glanced quickly around, at the pack from which Aisha took small sections for each braid, at the pack that Halima was only just unwrapping.
"Oh, my God! So that's how it's done. I used to think African-American women with braided hair had such full hair."
"No, we use attachments,"
Mariama said, smiling.
"Maybe next time. I think I'll just do my own hair today,"
Kelsey said. Her hair did not take long. 7 cornrows, the 2 fine hair already slackening in the plaits.
"It's great," she said afterwards.
"Thank you," Mariama said. "Please, come back again. I can do another style for you next time."
"Great!"
Ifemelu watched Mariama in the mirror, thinking of her own new American selves. It was with Kurt that she had first looked in the mirror, and with a flush of accomplishment, seen someone else. Kurt liked to say that it was love at first laugh. Whenever people asked how they met, even people they hardly knew, he would tell the story of how Kimberly had introduced them, he the cousin visiting from Maryland, she the Nigerian babysitter whom Kimberly talked so much about, and how taken he was by her deep voice, by the braid that had escaped from her rubber band. But it was when Taylor dashed into the den, wearing a blue cape and underwear, shouting,
"I am Captain Underpants!"
and she threw back her head and laughed, that he had fallen in love. Her laugh was so vibrant, shoulders shaking, chest heaving. It was the laugh of a woman who, when she laughed, really laughed. Sometimes when they were alone, and she laughed, he would say teasingly,
"That's what got me. And you know what I thought? If she laughs like that, I wonder how she does other things."
He told her, too, that she had known he was smitten. How could she not know? But pretended not to, because she didn't want a white man. In truth, she did not notice his interest. She had always been able to sense the desire of men, but not Kurt's, not at first. She still thought of Blaine, saw him walking along the platform at the New Haven train station, an apparition that filled her with a doomed yearning. She had not merely been attracted to Blaine, she had been arrested by Blaine, and in her mind he had become the perfect American partner that she would never have. Still, she had had other crushes since then, minor compared to that strike on the train, and had only just emerged from a crush on Abe in her ethics class. Abe, who was white, Abe, who liked her well enough, who thought her smart and funny, even attractive, but who did not see her as female. She was curious about Abe, interested in Abe, but all the flirting she did was to him merely niceness. Abe would hook her up with his black friend, if he had a black friend. She was invisible to Abe. This crushed her crush, and perhaps also made her overlook Kurt, until one afternoon when she was playing catch with Taylor, who threw the ball high, too high, and it fell into the thicket near the neighbor's cherry tree. "I think we've lost that one," Ifemelu said. The week before, a frisbee had disappeared in there. Kurt rose from the patio chair. He had been watching her every move, he told her later, and bounded into the bush, almost diving, as though into a pool, and emerged with the yellow ball.
"Yay, Uncle Kurt!"
Taylor said. But Kurt did not give Taylor the ball. Instead, he held it out to Ifemelu. She saw in his eyes what he wanted her to see. She smiled and said, "Thank you." Later in the kitchen, after she had put in a video for Taylor and was drinking a glass of water, he said, "This is where I ask you to dinner, but at this point I'll take anything I can get. May I buy you a drink, an ice cream, a meal, a movie ticket, this evening, this weekend, before I go back to Maryland?" He was looking at her with wonder, his head slightly lowered, and she felt an unfurling inside her. How glorious it was to be so wanted, and by this man with a rakish metal band around his wrist and the cleft-chinned handsomeness of models in department store catalogues. She began to like him because he liked her. "You eat so delicately," he told her on their first date, at an Italian restaurant in Old City. There was nothing particularly delicate about her raising a fork to her mouth, but she liked that he thought that there was.
"So, I'm a rich white guy from Potomac, but I'm not nearly as much of an asshole as I'm supposed to be,"
he said, in a way that made her feel he had said that before, and that it had been received well when he did.
"Laura always says my mom is richer than God, but I'm not sure she is."
He talked about himself with such gusto, as though determined to tell her everything there was to know, and all at once. His family had been hoteliers for 100 years. He went to college in California to escape them. He graduated and traveled through Latin America and Asia. Something began to pull him homewards, perhaps his father's death, perhaps his unhappiness with a relationship. So he moved a year ago back to Maryland, started a software business just so that he would not be in the family business, bought an apartment in Baltimore, and went down to Potomac every Sunday to have brunch with his mother. He talked about himself with an uncluttered simplicity, assuming that she enjoyed his stories simply because he enjoyed them himself. His boyish enthusiasm fascinated her. His body was firm as they hugged goodnight in front of her apartment.
"I'm about to move in for a kiss in exactly 3 seconds," he said. "A real kiss that can take us places. So if you don't want that to happen, you might want to back off right now."
She did not back off. The kiss was arousing in the way that unknown things are arousing. Afterwards, he said with urgency,
"We have to tell Kimberly."
"Tell Kimberly what?"
"That we're dating."
"We are?" He laughed, and she laughed too, although she had not been joking. He was open and gushing. Cynicism did not occur to him. She felt charmed and almost helpless in the face of this, carried along by him. Perhaps they were indeed dating after one kiss, since he was so sure that they were. Kimberly's greeting to her the next day was,
"Hello there, lovebird."
"So you'll forgive your cousin for asking out the help?"
Ifemelu asked. Kimberly laughed, and then, in an act that both surprised and moved Ifemelu, Kimberly hugged her. They moved apart awkwardly. Oprah was on the TV in the den, and she heard the audience erupt in applause.
"Well,"
Kimberly said, looking a little startled by the hug herself,
"I just wanted to say I'm really happy for you both."
"Thank you.
But it's only been one date, and there has been no consummation."
Kimberly giggled, and for a moment it felt as though they were high school girlfriends gossiping about boys. Ifemelu sometimes sensed, underneath the well-oiled sequences of Kimberly's life, a flash of regret, not only for things she longed for in the present, but for things she had longed for in the past.
"You should have seen Kurt this morning," Kimberly said. "I've never seen him like this. He's really excited."
"About what?" Morgan asked. She was standing by the kitchen entrance, her prepubescent body stiff with hostility. Behind her, Taylor was trying to straighten the legs of a small plastic robot.
"Well, honey, you're going to have to ask Uncle Kurt."
Kurt came into the kitchen, smiling shyly, his hair slightly wet, wearing a fresh light cologne.
"Hey,"
he said. He had called her at night to say he couldn't sleep.
"This is really corny, but I am so full of you. It's like I'm breathing you, you know,"
he had said. And she thought that the romance novelists were wrong, and it was men, not women, who were the true romantics.
"Morgan is asking why you seem so excited,"
Kimberly said.
"Well, Morg, I'm excited because I have a new girlfriend, somebody really special who you might know."
Ifemelu wished Kurt would remove the arm he had thrown around her shoulder. They were not announcing their engagement, for goodness sake. Morgan was staring at them. Ifemelu saw Kurt through her eyes, the dashing uncle who traveled the world and told all the really funny jokes at Thanksgiving dinner, the cool one, young enough to get her, but old enough to try and make her mother get her.
"Ifemelu is your girlfriend?" Morgan asked.
"Yep," Kurt said. "That's disgusting," Morgan said, looking genuinely disgusted.
"Morgan,"
Kimberly said. Morgan turned and stalked off upstairs.
"She has a crush on Uncle Kurt,
and now the babysitter steps onto her turf. It can't be easy, Ifemelu said. Taylor, who seemed happy both with the news and with having straightened out the robot's legs, said,
Are you and Ifemelu going to get married and have a baby, Uncle Kurt?
Well, buddy, right now we're just going to be spending a lot of time together to get to know each other.
Oh, okay,
Taylor said, slightly dampened. But when Don came home, Taylor ran into his arms and said,
Ifemelu and Uncle Kurt are going to get married and have a baby.
Oh, Don said. His surprise reminded Ifemelu of Abe in her ethics class. Don thought she was attractive and interesting, and thought Kurt was attractive and interesting, but it did not occur to him to think of both of them, together, entangled in the delicate threads of romance. Kurt had never been with a black woman. He told her this after their first time, in his penthouse apartment in Baltimore, with a self-mocking toss of his head, as if this was something he should have done long ago, but had somehow neglected. "Here's to a milestone, then," she said, pretending to raise a glass. Wambui once said, after Dorothy introduced them to her new Dutch boyfriend at an ASA meeting, "I can't do a white man. I'd be scared to see him naked, all that paleness, unless maybe an Italian with a serious tan, or a Jewish guy, dark Jewish." Ifemelu looked at Kurt's pale hair and pale skin, the rust-coloured moles on his back, the fine sprinkle of golden chest hair, and thought how strongly, at this moment, she disagreed with Wambui. "You are so sexy," she said.
"You are sexier."
He told her he had never been so attracted to a woman before, had never seen a body so beautiful, her perfect breasts, her perfect butt. It amused her that he considered a perfect butt what Obinze called a flat ass, and she thought her breasts were ordinary, big breasts, already with a downward slope. But his words pleased her, like an unnecessary lavish gift. He wanted to suck her finger, to lick honey from her nipple, to smear ice cream on her belly, as though it was not enough simply to lie bare skin to bare skin. Later, when he wanted to do impersonations, "How about you be Foxy Brown?" he said. She thought it endearing, his ability to act, to lose himself so completely in character, and she played along, humouring him, pleased by his pleasure, although it puzzled her that this could be so exciting to him. Often, naked beside him, she found herself thinking of Obinze. She struggled not to compare Kurt's touch to his. She had told Kurt about her secondary school boyfriend Moffe, but she said nothing about Obinze. It felt a sacrilege to discuss Obinze, to refer to him as an ex, that flippant word that said nothing and meant nothing. With each month of silence that passed between them, she felt the silence itself calcify and become a hard and hulking statue, impossible to defeat. She still often began to write to him, but always she stopped. Always she decided not to send the emails. With Kurt, she became, in her mind, a woman free of knots and cares, a woman running in the rain with the taste of sun-warmed strawberries in her mouth. A drink became a part of the architecture of her life, mojitos and martinis, dry whites and fruity reds. She went hiking with him, kayaking, camping near his family's vacation home, all things she would never have imagined herself doing before. She was lighter and leaner. She was Kurt's girlfriend, a role she slipped into as into a favourite flattering dress. She laughed more because he laughed so much. His optimism blinded her. He was full of plans.
"I have an idea," he said often.
She imagined him as a child, surrounded by too many brightly coloured toys, always being encouraged to carry out projects, always being told that his mundane ideas were wonderful.
"Let's go to Paris tomorrow," he said one weekend. "I know it's totally unoriginal, but you've never been, and I love that I get to show you Paris."
"I just can't get up and go to Paris. I have a Nigerian passport. I need to apply for a visa, with bank statements and health insurance, and all sorts of proof that I won't stay and become a burden to Europe."
"Yeah, I forgot about that. Okay, we'll go next weekend. We'll get the visa stuff done this week. I'll get a copy of my bank statement tomorrow."
"Curtis," she said, a little sternly, to make him be reasonable.
But standing there looking down at the city from so high up, she was already caught in the whirl of his excitement. He was upbeat, relentlessly so, in a way that only an American of his kind could be. And there was an infantile quality to this that she found admirable and repulsive. One day they took a walk on South Street, because she had never seen what he told her was the best part of Philadelphia. And he slipped his hand into hers as they wandered past tattoo parlors and groups of boys with pink hair. Near Condom Kingdom, he ducked into a tiny taro shop, pulling her along. A woman in a black veil told them, "I see light and long-term happiness ahead for you two." And Kurt said, "So do we," and gave her an extra $10. Later, when his ebullience became a temptation to Ifemelu, an unrelieved sunniness that made her want to strike at it, to crush it, this would be one of her best memories of Kurt, as he was in the taro shop on South Street, on a day filled with the promise of summer. So handsome, so happy, a true believer. He believed in good omens and positive thoughts and happy endings to films, a trouble-free belief, because he had not considered them deeply before choosing to believe. He just simply believed. Chapter 19. Kurt's mother had a bloodless elegance, her hair shiny, her complexion well-preserved, her tasteful and expensive clothes made to look tasteful and expensive. She seemed like the kind of wealthy person who did not tip well. Kurt called her mother, which had a certain formality, an archaic ring. On Sundays they had brunch with her. Ifemelu enjoyed the Sunday ritual of those meals in the ornate hotel dining room, full of nicely dressed people, silver-haired couples with their grandchildren, middle-aged women with brooches pinned on their lapels. The only other black person was a stiffly dressed waiter. She ate fluffy eggs and thinly sliced salmon and crescents of fresh melon, watching Kurt and his mother, both blindingly golden-haired. Kurt talked while his mother listened rapt. She adored her son, the child born late in life when she wasn't sure she could still have children, the charmer, the one whose manipulation she always gave into. He was her adventurer, who would bring back exotic species. He had dated a Japanese girl, a Venezuelan girl, but would, with time, settle down properly. She would tolerate anybody he liked, but she felt no obligation for affection. "I'm Republican. Our whole family is. We are very anti-welfare, but we did very much support civil rights. I just want you to know the kind of Republicans we are," she told Ifemelu when they first met, as though it was the most important thing to get out of the way. "And would you like to know what kind of Republican I am?" Ifemelu asked. His mother first looked surprised, and then her face stretched into a tight smile. "You're funny," she said. Once his mother told Ifemelu, "Your lashes are pretty." Abrupt, unexpected words. And then sipped her Bellini as though she had not heard Ifemelu's surprised, "Thank you." On the drive back to Baltimore, Ifemelu said, "Lashes? She must have tried really hard to find something to compliment." Kurt laughed. "Laura says my mother doesn't like beautiful women." One weekend, Morgan visited. Kimberly and Don wanted to take the children to Florida, but Morgan refused to go. So Kurt asked her to spend the weekend in Baltimore. He planned a boating trip, and Ifemelu thought he should have some time alone with Morgan. "You're not coming, Ifemelu?" Morgan asked, looking deflated. "I thought we were all going together." The word "together" said with more animation than Ifemelu had ever heard from Morgan. "Oh, of course I'm coming," she said. As she put on mascara and lip gloss, Morgan watched. "Come here, Morg," she said. And she ran the lip gloss over Morgan's lips. "Smack your lips. Good. Now, why are you so pretty, Miss Morgan?" Morgan laughed. On the pier, Ifemelu and Kurt walked along, each holding Morgan's hand, Morgan happy to have her hands held. And Ifemelu thought, as she sometimes fleetingly did, of being married to Kurt, their life engraved in comfort, he getting along with her family and friends, and she with his, except for his mother. They joked about marriage. Since she first told him about bride price ceremonies, that Igbo people did them before the wine-carrying and church wedding. He joked about going to Nigeria to pay her bride price, arriving at her ancestral home, sitting with her father and uncles, and insisting he get her for free. And she joked in return about walking down the aisle in a church in Virginia to the tune of "Here Comes the Bride," while his relatives stared in horror and asked one another in whispers why the help was wearing the bride's dress. They were curled upon the couch, she reading a novel, he watching sports. She found it endearing how absorbed he was in his games, eyes small and still in concentration. During commercial breaks, she teased him. Why did American football have no inherent logic, just overweight men jumping on top of one another? And why did baseball players spend so much time spitting and then making sudden incomprehensible runs? He laughed and tried to explain, yet again, the meaning of home runs and touchdowns, but she was uninterested, because understanding meant she could no longer tease him, and so she glanced back at her novel, ready to tease him again at the next break. The couch was soft. Her skin was glowing. At school, she took extra credits and raised her GPA. Outside the tall living room windows, the inner harbour spread out below, water gleaming and lights twinkling. A sense of contentment overwhelmed her. That was what Kurt had given her, this gift of contentment, of ease. How quickly she had become used to their life, her passport filled with visa stamps, the solicitousness of flight attendants in first-class cabins, the feathery bed linen in the hotels they stayed in, and the little things she hoarded, jars of preserves from the breakfast tray, little vials of conditioner, woven slippers, even face towels if they were especially soft. She had slipped out of her old skin. She almost liked winter. The glittering coat of frosted ice on the tops of cars, the lush warmth of the cashmere sweaters Kurt bought her. In stores, he did not look first at the prices of things. He bought her groceries and textbooks, sent her gift certificates for department stores, took her shopping himself. He asked her to give up babysitting. They could spend more time together if she didn't have to work every day. But she refused. "I have to have a job," she said. She saved money, sent more home. She wanted her parents to move to a new flat. There had been an armed robbery in the block of flats next to theirs. "Something bigger, in a better neighborhood," she said.
"We are okay here," her mother said. "It's not too bad. They built a new gate in the street and banned Okadas after 6 p.m., so it is safe."
"A gate?"
"Yes, near the kiosk."
"Which kiosk?"
"You don't remember the kiosk?" her mother asked.
Ifemelu paused. A sepia tone to her memories. She could not remember the kiosk. Her father had finally found a job as the deputy director of human resources in one of the new banks. He bought a mobile phone. He bought new tires for her mother's car. Slowly, he was easing back into his monologues about Nigeria.
"One could not describe Obasanjo as a good man, but it must be conceded that he has done some good things in the country. There is a flourishing spirit of entrepreneurship," he said.
It felt strange to call them directly, to hear her father's
"Hello?"
after the second ring. And when he heard her voice, he raised his, almost shouting, as he always did with international calls. Her mother liked to take the phone out to the veranda to make sure the neighbours overheard.
"Ifem, how is the weather in America?"
Her mother asked breezy questions and accepted breezy replies.
"Everything is going well."
And Ifemelu had no choice but to say yes. Her father remembered classes she'd mentioned and asked about specifics. She chose her words, careful not to say anything about Kurt. It was easier not to tell them about Kurt.
"What are your employment prospects?"
her father asked. Her graduation was approaching, her student visa expiring.
"I've been assigned to a career counselor, and I'm meeting her next week," she said.
"All graduating students have a counselor assigned to them?"
"Yes."
Her father made a sound of admiring respect.
"America is an organized place, and job opportunities are rife there."
"Yes, they have placed many students in good jobs," Ifemelu said.
It was untrue, but it was what her father expected to hear. The career services office, an airless space, piles of files sitting forlornly on desks, was known to be full of counsellors who reviewed resumes and asked you to change the font or format and gave you outdated contact information for people who never called you back. The first time Ifemelu went there, her counsellor, Ruth, a caramel-skinned African-American woman, asked, "What do you really want to do?"
"I want a job."
"Yes, but what kind?" Ruth asked, slightly incredulous. Ifemelu looked at her resume on the table.
"I'm a communications major, so anything in communications, the media."
"Do you have a passion, a dream job?" Ifemelu shook her head. She felt weak for not having a passion, not being sure what she wanted to do. Her interests were vague and varied. Magazine publishing, fashion, politics, television, none of them had a firm shape. She attended the school career fair, where students wore awkward suits and serious expressions and tried to look like adults worthy of real jobs. The recruiters, themselves not long out of college, the young who had been sent out to catch the young, told her about opportunity for growth and good fit and benefits. But they all became non-committal when they realized she was not an American citizen, that they would, if they hired her, have to descend into the dark tunnel of immigration paperwork. "I should have majored in engineering or something," she told Kurt. "Communications majors are a dime a dozen."
"I know some people my dad did business with. They might be able to help," Kurt said.
And not long afterwards, he told her she had an interview at an office in downtown Baltimore for a position in public relations.
"All you need to do is ace the interview and it's yours," he said. "So I know folks in this other, bigger place, but the good thing about this one is they'll get you a work visa and start your green card process."
"What? How did you do it?" He shrugged.
"Made some calls."
"Kurt, really, I don't know how to thank you."
"I have some ideas," he said, boyishly pleased.
It was good news, and yet a soberness wrapped itself around her. Wambui was working 3 jobs under the table to raise the $5,000 she would need to pay an African-American man for a green card marriage. Mombek was desperately trying to find a company that would hire him on his temporary visa, and here she was, a pink balloon, weightless, floating to the top, propelled by things outside of herself. She felt in the midst of her gratitude a small resentment that Kurt could, with a few calls, rearrange the world, have things slide into the spaces that he wanted them to. When she told Ruth about the interview in Baltimore, Ruth said,
"My only advice? Lose the braids and straighten your hair. Nobody says this kind of stuff, but it matters. We want you to get that job."
Auntie Uju had said something similar in the past, and she had laughed then. Now she knew enough not to laugh. "Thank you," she said to Ruth. Since she came to America, she had always braided her hair with long extensions, always alarmed at how much it cost. She wore each style for 3 months, even 4 months, until her scalp itched unbearably and the braid sprouted fuzzily from a bed of new growth. And so it was a new adventure, relaxing her hair. She removed her braids, careful to leave her scalp unscratched, to leave undisturbed the dirt that would protect it. Relaxers had grown in their range, boxes and boxes in the ethnic hair section of the drugstore, faces of smiling black women with impossibly straight and shiny hair, beside words like botanical and aloe that promised gentleness. She bought one in a green carton. In her bathroom, she carefully smeared the protective gel around her hairline before she began to slather the creamy relaxer on her hair, section by section, her fingers in plastic gloves. The smell reminded her of chemistry lab in secondary school, and so she forced open the bathroom window, which was often jammed. She timed the process carefully, washing off the relaxer in exactly 20 minutes, but her hair remained kinky, its denseness unchanged. The relaxer did not take. That was the word, take, that the hairdresser in West Philadelphia used.
"Girl, you need a professional,"
the hairdresser said as she reapplied another relaxer.
"People think they're saving money by doing it at home, but they're really not."
Ifemelu felt only a slight burning at first, but as the hairdresser rinsed out the relaxer, Ifemelu's head bent backwards against a plastic sink. Needles of stinging pain shot up from different parts of her scalp, down to different parts of her body, back up to her head.
"Just a little burn," the hairdresser said. "But look how pretty it is. Wow, girl, you got the white girl swing."
Her hair was hanging down rather than standing up, straight and sleek, parted at the side and curving to a slight bob at her chin. The verve was gone. She did not recognize herself. She left the salon almost mournfully. While the hairdresser had flat-ironed the ends, the smell of burning, of something organic dying which should not have died, had made her feel a sense of loss. Kurt looked uncertain when he saw her.
"Do you like it, babe?"
he asked. "I can see you don't," she said. He said nothing. He reached out to stroke her hair, as though doing so might make him like it. She pushed him away. "Ouch, careful. I have a bit of relaxabon."
"What?"
"It's not too bad.
I used to get it all the time in Nigeria. Look at this."
She showed him a keloid behind her ear, a small enraged swelling of skin, which she got after Auntie Uju straightened her hair with a hot comb in secondary school.
"Pull back your ear," Auntie Uju often said, and Ifemelu would hold her ear tense and unbreathing, terrified that the red-hot comb fresh from the stove would burn her, but also excited by the prospect of straight, swingy hair. And one day it did burn her, as she moved slightly, and Auntie Uju's hand moved slightly, and the hot metal singed the skin behind her ear.
"Oh, my God," Kurt said, his eyes wide.
He insisted on gently looking at her scalp to see how much she had been hurt.
"Oh, my God!"
His horror made her more concerned than she would ordinarily have been. She had never felt so close to him as she did then, sitting still on the bed, her face sunk in his shirt, the scent of fabric softener in her nose, while he gently parted her newly straightened hair.
"Why do you have to do this? Your hair was gorgeous braided, and when you took out the braids the last time and just kind of let it be, it was even more gorgeous, so full and cool."
"My full and cool hair would work if I were interviewing to be a backup singer in a jazz band, but I need to look professional for this interview. And professional means straight is best, but if it's going to be curly, then it has to be the white kind of curly, loose curls, or at worst, spiral curls, but never kinky. It's so fucking wrong that you have to do this."
At night, she struggled to find a comfortable position on her pillow. 2 days later, there were scabs on her scalp. 3 days later, they oozed pus. Kurt wanted her to see a doctor, and she laughed at him. It would heal, she told him, and it did. Later, after she breezed through the job interview, and the woman shook her hand and said she would be a wonderful fit in the company, she wondered if the woman would have felt the same way had she walked into that office wearing her thick, kinky, God-given halo of hair, the afro. She did not tell her parents how she got the job. Her father said,
"I have no doubt that you will excel. America creates opportunities for people to thrive. Nigeria can indeed learn a lot from them."
While her mother began to sing when Ifemelu said that in a few years she could become an American citizen.
Understanding America for the Non-American Black. What do WASPs aspire to? Professor Hunk has a visiting professor colleague, a Jewish guy with a thick accent from the kind of European country where most people drink a glass of anti-Semitism at breakfast. So Professor Hunk was talking about civil rights, and Jewish guy says, "The blacks have not suffered like the Jews." Professor Hunk replies, "Come on, is this the Oppression Olympics?" Jewish guy did not know this, but Oppression Olympics is what smart liberal Americans say to make you feel stupid and to make you shut up. But there is an Oppression Olympics going on. American racial minorities, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, and Jews, all get shit from white folks. Different kinds of shit, but shit still. Each secretly believes that it gets the worst shit. So no, there is no United League of the Oppressed. However, all the others think they're better than blacks because, well, they're not black. Take Lily, for example, the coffee-skinned, black-haired and Spanish-speaking woman who cleaned my aunt's house in a New England town. She had a great hauteur. She was disrespectful, cleaned poorly, made demands.
My aunt believed Lily didn't like working for black people. Before she finally fired her, my aunt said, "Stupid woman, she thinks she's white." So whiteness is the thing to aspire to. Not everyone does, of course. Please, commenters, don't state the obvious. But many minorities have a conflicted longing for WASP whiteness, or more accurately, the privileges of WASP whiteness. They probably don't really like pale skin, but they certainly like walking into a store without some security dude following them. Hating your goy and eating one too, as the great Philip Roth put it. So if everyone in America aspires to be WASPs, then what do WASPs aspire to? Does anyone know?
Chapter 20. Ifemelu came to love Baltimore, for its scrappy charm, its streets of faded glory, its farmer's market that appeared on weekends under the bridge, bursting with green vegetables and plump fruit and virtuous souls. Although never as much as her first love, Philadelphia, that city that held history in its gentle clasp. But when she arrived in Baltimore, knowing she was going to live there and not merely visiting Kurt, she thought it forlorn and unlovable. The buildings were joined to one another in faded, slumping rows, and on shabby corners people were hunched in puffy jackets, black and bleak people, waiting for buses, the air around them hazed in gloom. Many of the drivers outside the train station were Ethiopian or Punjabi. Her Ethiopian taxi driver said, "I can't place your accent. Where are you from?"
"Nigeria."
"Nigeria? You don't look African at all."
"Why don't I look African?"
"Because your blouse is too tight."
"It is not too tight.
I thought you were from Trinidad or one of those places."
He was looking in the rear view with disapproval and concern.
"You have to be very careful, or America will corrupt you."
When years later she wrote the blog post on the divisions within the membership of non-American blacks in America, she wrote about the taxi driver. But she wrote of it as the experience of someone else, careful not to let on whether she was African or Caribbean, because her readers did not know which she was. She told Kurt about the taxi driver, how his sincerity had infuriated her, and how she had gone to the station bathroom to see if her pink long-sleeved blouse was too tight. Kurt laughed and laughed. It became one of the many stories he liked to tell friends.
"She actually went to the bathroom to look at her blouse?"
His friends were like him, sunny and wealthy people who existed on the glimmering surface of things. She liked them, and sensed they liked her. To them she was interesting, unusual in the way she bluntly spoke her mind. They expected certain things of her, and forgave certain things from her, because she was foreign. Once, sitting with them in a bar, she heard Kurt talking to Brad, and Kurt said,
"Blowhard."
She was struck by the word, by the irredeemable Americanness of it, blowhard. It was a word that would never occur to her. To understand this was to realize that Kurt and his friends would, on some level, never be fully knowable to her. She got an apartment in Charles Village, a one-bedroom with old wood floors, although she might as well have been living with Kurt. Most of her clothes were in his walk-in closet, lined with mirrors. Now that she saw him every day, no longer just on weekends, she saw new layers of him. How difficult it was for him to be still, simply still without thinking of what next to do. How used he was to stepping out of his trousers and leaving them on the floor for days until the cleaning woman came. Their lives were full of plans he made. Cozumel for one night, London for a long weekend, and she sometimes took a taxi on Friday evenings after work to meet him at the airport.
"Isn't this great?"
he would ask her, and she would say yes, it was great. He was always thinking of what else to do, and she told him that it was rare for her, because she had grown up not doing, but being. She added quickly, though, that she liked it all, because she did like it, and she knew, too, how much he needed to hear that. In bed, he was anxious.
"Do you like that? Do you enjoy me?"
he asked often, and she said yes, which was true, but she sensed that he did not always believe her, or that his belief lasted only so long before he would need to hear her affirmation again. There was something in him, lighter than ego but darker than insecurity, that needed constant buffing, polishing, waxing. And then her hair began to fall out at the temples. She drenched it in rich, creamy conditioners and sat under steamers until water droplets ran down her neck. Still, her hairline shifted further backwards each day.
"It's the chemicals," Wambui told her. "Do you know what's in a relaxer? That stuff can kill you. You need to cut your hair and go natural."
Mambui's hair was now in short locks, which Ifemelu did not like. She thought them sparse and dull, unflattering to Wambui's pretty face.
"I don't want dreads," she said. "It doesn't have to be dreads. You can wear an afro, or braids like you used to. There's a lot you can do with natural hair."
"I can't just cut my hair," she said.
"Relaxing your hair is like being in prison. You're caged in. Your hair rules you. You didn't go running with Kurt today because you don't want to sweat out the straightness. That picture you sent me, you had your hair covered on the boat. You're always battling to make your hair do what it wasn't meant to do. If you go natural and take good care of your hair, it won't fall off like it's doing now. I can help you cut it right now. No need to think about it too much."
Wambui was so sure, so convincing. Ifemelu found a pair of scissors. Wambui cut her hair, leaving only 2 inches, the new growth since her last relaxer. Ifemelu looked in the mirror. She was all big eyes and big head. At best, she looked like a boy. At worst, like an insect.
"I look so ugly. I'm scared of myself."
"You look beautiful. Your bone structure shows so well now. You're just not used to seeing yourself like this. You'll get used to it," Wambui said.
Ifemelu was still staring at her hair. What had she done? She looked unfinished, as though the hair itself, short and stubby, was asking for attention, for something to be done to it, for more. After Wambui left, she went to the drugstore. Kurt's baseball hat pulled over her head. She bought oils and pomades, applying one and then the other on wet hair and then on dry hair, willing an unknown miracle to happen. Something, anything that would make her like her hair. She thought of buying a wig, but wigs brought anxiety, the always present possibility of flying off your head. She thought of a texturizer to loosen her hair's springy coils, stretch out the kinkiness a little. But a texturizer was really a relaxer, only milder, and she would still have to avoid the rain. Kurt told her, "Stop stressing, babe. It's a really cool and brave look."
"I don't want my hair to be brave. I mean, like, stylish, chic."
He paused.
"You look beautiful."
"I look like a boy."
Kurt said nothing. There was in his expression a veiled amusement, as though he did not see why she should be so upset, but was better off not saying so. The next day she called in sick and climbed back into bed.
"You didn't call in sick so we could stay a day longer in Bermuda, but you call in sick because of your hair?"
Kurt asked, propped up by pillows, stifling laughter.
"I can't go out like this."
She was burrowing under the covers as though to hide.
"It's not as bad as you think,"
he said.
"At least you finally accept that it's bad."
Kurt laughed.
"You know what I mean. Come here."
He hugged her, kissed her, and then slid down and began to massage her feet. She liked the warm pressure, the feel of his fingers, yet she could not relax. In the bathroom mirror, her hair had startled her, dull and shrunken from sleep, like a mop of wool sitting on her head. She reached for her phone and sent Wambui a text.
"I hate my hair. I couldn't go to work today."
Wambui's reply came minutes later.
"Go online. happilykinkynappy.com. It's the natural hair community. You'll find inspiration."
She showed the text to Kurt.
"What a silly name for the website."
"I know, but it sounds like a good idea. You should check it out sometime."
"Like now," Ifemelu said, getting up.
Kurt's laptop was open on the desk. As she went to it, she noticed a change in Kurt, a sudden tense quickness. His ashen, panicked move towards the laptop.
"What's wrong?"
she asked.
"They mean nothing. The emails mean nothing."
She stared at him, forcing her mind to work. He had not expected her to use his computer, because she hardly ever did. He was cheating on her. How odd that she had never considered that. She picked up the laptop, held it tightly, but he didn't try to reach for it. He just stood and watched. The Yahoo mail page was minimized,